You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, has been getting lots of attention by the national media and is a National Book Award finalist. The author of the book is a University of Michigan professor of history, Heather Ann Thompson, and she joins us now. First, congratulations on the success.
Thank you so much.
So let's start with the story itself. This is about a prison riot and retaliation in a facility in upstate New York. Tell us about the living conditions at the prison and some of the political climate of the time.
So this is an upstate New York prison. It's a maximum security prison. It still exists today. And interestingly, today it looks exactly as it did in 1971, which is just what it looked like in the Depression when it was built, which was archaic, very, very overcrowded, and terrible living conditions. 2,400 men crammed in this facility. Insufficient food for these men, being fed on 63 cents a day, having insufficient sanitary supplies, being treated really barbarically by the medical staff. And essentially, this is a group of men who understand that they are human beings and that they have a right to basic human rights in a prison. And they had also been inspired by the civil rights activism happening outside of prison walls. This is 1971, and very much the walls between prison and the outside were porous in terms of the idea that one could protest for better conditions.
Right, and this is an age of black empowerment. Of the prison population, about how many were African American? And I'm asking that because I wonder how much race was a factor in the events that led up and followed.
Well, there's no question that the prison is majority black and Puerto Rican, but there were many, many white prisoners in Attica as well. And indeed, this whole protest will go down as very much a black power protest, and in key ways it was. But the brutal living conditions were so much in people's minds that it united these guys across racial lines, across barriers of language. There were many Spanish-speaking prisoners in this facility, and many different political points of view. So what's really remarkable is how 1,300 men stand together on those fundamental question of rights, despite differences of race and language and politics.
The prisoners took over the prison, and like a lot of things in history, it started with a fairly minor event, but it was the culmination of all those conditions you talked about. What sparked the riot?
Well, so these guys had for months and months and months been trying to get some remedy through the system, writing letters, sending petitions, and indeed they'd even had a strike. They had sat down in the metal shop of Attica to ask for better wages and, again, better conditions. But this got them very little. And so what happened was, again, as you mentioned, a very insignificant or I should say regular incident of prison management overreacting, clamping down on prisoners, and in this case, locking them in a hallway, not letting them go out to rec one morning after breakfast, failing to tell the guards in charge of these guys that that was going to be the plan. And needless to say, that early morning on September 9th, utter chaos ensues. People are panicked. They feel like they're being trapped, that they're about ready to be descended on and beaten. And so that's where the riot begins. But within an hour, remarkable order has been established out in one of the exercise yards. And an extraordinary experiment in participatory democracy really begins.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, these guys, they moved to D Yard because they all want to be out in the open, both for their own safety and also for the safety of the guards whom they've taken hostages. They take guards hostage because they understand they need the state to bargain with them and feel pretty strongly that the state will at least protect their own. So they set up this tent city. They have a medical station, a food station. They elect representatives out of each of the cell blocks to come up to this negotiating table to speak for them. They ask for the media to come in because they understand that prisons are places where anything can go wrong because no one from the outside is ever allowed to see. So they invite the media in, and and they ask for observers, one of whom was Michigan's own Jim Ingram from the Michigan Chronicle. And they want those observers to come in to make sure that negotiations with the state proceed in good faith and to make sure that they are protected as they go on.
So let's get an idea. How long were the prisoners in control of Attica?
So they were there from September 9th in the early morning until the state retakes the prison that same time, early morning on September 13th.
Okay.
So four long days and long nights.
So there are negotiations going on. What kind of negotiations? What were they like between the prisoners and New York government officials?
Well, the primary negotiator for New York was the Commissioner of Corrections, a liberal prison reformer by the name of Russell Oswald. And the negotiations go on between him and, again, the elected negotiators up at the table in D-Yard. And they continue with the observers being the sort of emissaries, going and hearing what the prisoners need, going back, talking to the prison administrators inside of the prison on the outside of the area controlled by the prisoners. And the demands were first unwieldy and some quite unrealistic, but through a process of consensus and much discussion and a pushing on the part of the observers to nail down, you know, very, very clear demands, the demands were about 32 very clear-cut human rights demands ranging from, decent food to the right to practice one's religion, to more humane and clearer parole rules and so forth. Very, very basic.
So they have a sketch of an agreement. There's going to be a retaking of the prison, and that's when things really get out of hand. Tell me about that.
Well, meanwhile, while these negotiations are going on and people are putting their lives on the line to make sure that this ends peacefully, outside of the prison, every state trooper barrack had sent men to this prison, and so had corrections officers from all around the state had descended on Attica. And while these negotiations are going on for 4 days and long nights, these men are getting no sleep. They are being really fed on a diet of rumor about inmate atrocities going on the inside. This is the FBI who's helping to plant those. And they're passing out weapons. I mean, every imaginable weapon, some state issued, being passed out of the back of trucks with no regard to serial number or who has what weapon, to personal weapons, ammunition outlawed by the Geneva Convention. And these are the men whom on the fifth morning the governor of New York will send into this prison against the advice of everybody who was there.
A governor who we later elected or was appointed, I should say, vice president of the United States, Nelson Rockefeller. Now, the negotiators and the observers, including James Ingram of the Michigan Chronicle, decided to stay in the prison to observe the retaking of the prison, which was pretty risky. What did they see when you've got these state troopers and these correctional officers who have been, as you say, feeding on rumors for days?
Well, first, let me say for your listeners, just to get a picture of what this was like, before these nearly 600 troopers and corrections officers go into the prison, first, a very, very toxic gas had been dumped over D-Yard. And this was a powder. It clung to people's noses and in their nasal passages, and they were in their throats. And so folks were already debilitated. They were retching and falling to the ground. The gas immobilizes them. And this is when the troopers proceed their physical assault on Attica. Well, meanwhile, the observers who agreed to stay, and it wasn't all of them, but it was some of them, were in the observers' room. So they couldn't see inside of the yard, but they could feel the concussion of the gunfire. They could feel the concussion of the helicopter blades going overhead, dumping the gas. And they could certainly smell. And they were, really sickened by the gas. It was actually seeping through their own door. So they felt very much a part of it, but couldn't see the horror even themselves until later.
At the end, a total of 43 people are dead, including 10 correctional officers. There was an investigation into the prison uprising and the retaliation. What was the result? Why did 43 people die?
Well, it's a complicated story because some of those people actually were killed in the recesses of the prison by some prisoners at a different time. So they're not part of that state body count that we're really talking about right now. On the day of the retaking, law enforcement guns killed 39 men, prisoners and hostages alike, and they also wounded, severely wounded, 6 to 7 bullet holes in some cases, 128 other men. So you would imagine that after this, which is literally a carnage, that there will be some accountability, particularly members of law enforcement. Well, the book that I wrote really chronicles why that never happens. Why is it that only prisoners will ever be indicted for their role in the rebellion, but law enforcement never does any time, certainly doesn't even come, you know, has a day in court even. And that is because it turns out that the state of New York at every level of its government and then really beyond New York into the federal government, you know, helps to cover up what happened, actively covers up what happened. And the book, you know, spends 2/3 of the pages on that, both the cover up, but also the prisoner and hostage fight to make sure that their stories were eventually told.
We're talking with Heather Ann Thompson about her book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. The Attica Uprising took place 45 years ago, but government officials are still keeping many of these documents related to what happened secret. You filed Freedom of Information requests. They came back heavily redacted. You had a hard time getting access to many of the documents. Why are we still having this secrecy surrounding an event that happened 45 years ago?
Well, that's an excellent question. You know, again, we need to remember that prisons, whether it's Attica in 1971 or whether it's, you know, our own Michigan's Kinross facility today, these are public institutions. And we have, as citizens, a right to know what goes on behind those bars and behind those walls. And we don't. And so at Attica, it was extraordinarily difficult to get any information about what had gone down there in 1971, both because it was a prison, but also because, remember, 39 people have been killed by law enforcement, 128 others shot. And frankly, that's just the beginning. In the days, weeks, and months after the prison is under the control of the state, the prisoners are tortured. I mean, literally tortured. And so there's much to not want to talk about. And the state of New York has been very, very careful from the moment that the tear gas cleared over Attica to today into not releasing the documents. So my book took 13 years to write because it was about trying to figure out who had either the copy or the original of what the state didn't want me to see. That was in terms of the documents, probing what was really going on in that investigation, and frankly, talking to the survivors to make sure that I knew what happened from them.
You've been getting some great accolades from a number of reviewers and so forth, but you've also been getting some really nasty backlash from people about the revelations you make in your book, some of them really profane. Why do you think there's that reaction?
Well, it's interesting. I think part of the reaction that I've gotten is because I am a historian, but I also speak out today about prison conditions and speak out about police killings today in cities such as Charlotte, for example. I mean, some of the worst hate mail I got was after talking about the police shooting that recently happened in Charlotte, North Carolina. But there has been a great deal of at least concern, if not hostility, that I decided in this book to name the members of law enforcement who have been protected for 45 years, whom the state believed and had evidence against for killing prisoners and hostages alike, and frankly, also for torturing them. So I reveal those names. And all I can say to that is it was very painful to do that because I don't want to bring anyone harm, either the victims to have to relive this or even the members of law enforcement who have managed to protect themselves all those years. I mean, it's a very uncomfortable position when history meets the present like that for the author, for the historian. But at the same time, I am a historian. And so when I was writing what happened during the state's investigation of Attica, and part of that information was whom it believed had committed crimes there, I had no choice but to tell that part of the history too. Interestingly, the book also countless times mentions crimes that the state believed that the prisoners had done that they didn't do, right? Or that maybe sometimes they did do. But either way, nobody has ever said to me, why in the world are you dragging those men's name through the mud, especially when it's something they were not actually, had a trial for? No one cares if it's some of the hostages or the prisoners. What they care about is it's only if it's law enforcement. So I find that interesting, but I had no choice but to reveal what the history book needed to reveal to the public.
So what are the lessons yet to be learned from Attica?
Well, so many. I think first and foremost, what I hope the book does is that it reminds us all that those people who are behind bars are not something other. I mean, these are citizens. These are our mothers, our brothers, our sisters, our children. They're human beings. And that while some of them are guilty and some of them perhaps are not, the bottom line is their sentence is to be confined. It is not to be tortured. It is not to be abused. And we have a responsibility, since they have no obvious power inside of those institutions, to see what's going on. So I hope it gives us the sense of urgency that we need to know what's happening in our prisons, and that we have a responsibility to make sure that that the people in them are not being abused.
Earlier, you mentioned Kinross Correctional Facility in Michigan. There was a bit of a dust up there. The Department of Corrections says it was not a riot. The Union for the Correctional Officers say it was. But it sounds like the grievances the inmates were making there, while not as many as at Attica, were similar. And I was kind of surprised at reading the two lists of grievances. So what do you make of that? What does that tell us?
Well, I think the links are absolutely direct. One of the things that happens after Attica is that the state of New York tells utter lies about why there had been so much bloodshed there. They basically accused the prisoners of killing the hostages, which was a blatant lie. And that kind of lore about prisoners really gets cemented over the next 40 years. It leads to mass incarceration, but it also leads to the fact that prisoners today are experiencing worse conditions, which is almost unimaginable when you read my book, worse conditions than they were in 1971. More time behind bars, more solitary confinement, more physical abuse, rotten food. I mean, it's really horrendous. And so on September 9th of this year, prisoners across the country called for work stoppages and protests. And in many, many prisons, I mean, the media is only just now figuring out how many prisoners did, in fact, protest. Kinross was one of those places.
And we should remind everyone, this is the anniversary of the Attica uprising, and that's why that date was chosen.
Exactly. And at Kinross, which is, of course, a prison way far away from where these prisoners actually come from, right? This is way in the UP. It's out of sight, out of mind. We don't know what goes on there. Well, the prisoners were trying to tell us, and eventually the guards were trying to tell us. And I will tell you that the what we do know, letters coming out of Kinross and certainly accounts coming out of there, is that the retribution for those guys having rebelled was very severe as well. Indeed, there's an article in the Free Press about a prisoner that died a few hours after the retaking, and there's an investigation now. So we need to know what's happening, and frankly, we can't assume that it's all okay. Attica shows us that law enforcement and state officials went to extraordinary lengths to make sure we didn't know of the abuses inside. And it took me 13 years to recover them. I hope with Kinross today and Alabama and Ohio and all these other places where prisons are erupting, that we heed Attica's lesson and demand access, demand to know what's happening inside.
Heather Ann Thompson is a history professor at the University of Michigan, author of the book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, published by Pantheon. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much.